skydiving. This is amazing.
Yeah, but you know what else is amazing? An iPhone 6S for just $49 at Metro.
Really?
Imagine streaming all the way down with that amazing camera.
I'm switching.
That's smart.
You know what else is smart? Parachutes.
Switch to Metro and get an amazing iPhone 6S for only $49. Metro by T-Mobile. Phone offer requires port in of number not currently active on T-Mobile network or active on Metro in past 90 days. See store for details and terms and conditions.
This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751, or send in your question through the website www.beatyourgenes.org. All right, good evening, everybody. It's Nate G here, along with Dr. Doug Lyle. Dr. Lyle, how are you doing this evening?
Good, all is well. You doing good?
Doing fantastic. It's a little rainy, a little cold, but nothing compared to some of the parts in the country, so I will not complain anymore.
Yeah, very good.
But we've got some interesting questions this week, like the concept of free time. What should we be doing? I know you don't like the word should be doing. It's a concept from the How to Find Freedom in a Free World. But the question has to do with what about the concept of leisure and recreational activities? How did they exist in an ancestral environment? Now, this listener is asking that we like to think that we should have free time to have fun. But the question is, isn't watching a movie or listening to music just some sort of pleasure trap?
let's see now. There's going to be a couple of different broad motivations, broad targets of motivation. One of them is going to be to reduce the possibility of misery, and the other is going to be to increase the pleasantness of somebody's life. So that's what an animal is going to be doing. An animal is going to be angling. In other words, you have to run a cost benefit on the pain and misery associated with risk reward options in the environment, and then your mind is a gambling machine. It's attempting to handicap all the different options and try to think through, you know, what's the best total hedonic win. And the way your system is designed is to actually, when you get the biggest wins or you do that calculus the best, your life experience is about as good as it can be. And that's going to mean that you're going to wind up surviving and reproducing effectively. So it's not a perfect system. So the system actually wasn't designed to optimize your well-being. It was designed to optimize your gene survival. But those two things are pretty tightly correlated, and they go apart in different times. Now, when it comes to, quote, leisure, the leisure is something that, you know, that's a word we use for a set of activities that take place when there isn't pressure to try to avoid misery. So if you're like, hey, I don't have time to walk, goof off, I have to keep working hard to make the mortgage payment. Well, why? So that I don't have to sleep out in the cold. Well, why? Because it's unpleasant. Okay. So, and it's potentially dangerous. So when we actually look through why the person isn't doing leisure activities, it's because they are essentially trying to reduce the likelihood of misery. So we don't think of it quite in that way. We don't really understand that a lot of action that takes place that isn't particularly unpleasant is really designed as pain avoidance action, you know, with pain avoidance ends in sight. The when essentially you are wealthy and secure, safe enough that you don't have to be really worrying about risk mitigation on misery, then your mind starts to go to a different area of the great spreadsheet of life. It starts looking for what things it can do, what situations it can put itself in, essentially person, environment situations that will hit the happiness circuits or the pleasure circuits. So that's going to be what we call leisure. You know, it's really kind of a cool thing if people actually get pleasure or pleasantness out of their work. And a lot of people very much would like to do that, and a lot of people do, but a lot of people don't. So and obviously the work that is the least pleasant has a tendency to be paid, you know, relatively well relative to similarly level skilled work that is more pleasant, obviously, for the general principles of supply and demand for those markets. Now, back to leisure. So leisure is just a word that we use to say, okay, what else can you do now that you don't have to be worried about the wolf at the door or to even have a door? So if you know that you're going to be fed and you've got the fillings in the kids' teeth, and it turns out that you've got some money saved in the bank, so if there's some little tragedy, we're safe and secure. Now it's time to turn on the football game, okay? So it's going to turn out that a lot of leisure activities have to do with sexual displays. And so it's going to, as you would expect, so a whole lot of the grit and misery mitigation processes have to do with survival problems. So it's essentially, let's make damn sure that we're going to survive. Then when that gets taken care of, you would expect that the organism would start to drift its attention to reproductive problems. And you're going to find that reproductive problems are leisure. So some gal that wants to go shopping for clothes, that's a sexual motivation is what that is. We call it leisure. It's fun to go shopping. But what are we really seeing there? What we're seeing is that she's attempting to do things that will improve her sexual attractiveness. So that's what she's doing. A guy that's watching football is actually watching other people's sexual displays. And you might be saying, why the hell would he want to watch other people's sexual displays if they're males? And that is that people are very interested in the sexual displays of their own sex. They're inherently interested because they want to observe those people's strengths and weaknesses and compare themselves and join coalitions, you know, in theory and all that sort of thing. And so mirror neurons actually can also help a person seemingly have part of the experience of the individual that's actually doing the playing. That's a curious characteristic of humans that makes spectator sports and movies and things like that, you know, a possibility, or listen to somebody croon about how it is that, you know, they lost Barbara, the love of their life, and what are they going to do now? Well, we can feel all sad about it because when we listen to the guy sing, we can sort of feel the way he feels as a result of mirror neurons. So we're going to find that the so-called leisure activities are very much directed around sexual displays of one kind or another. A guy says, oh, no, I just like to play tennis for fun. Really? You're playing tennis because you're attempting to demonstrate superiority over a competitor with respect to athleticism. And so you don't know it necessarily, but you're angling for sexual cachet. If you collect coins, you're angling for sexual cachet. You don't know that you are, but you probably are. That's why you would expect that both performing sexual display functions as well as watching them would be inherently interesting. It doesn't do any good to have a species that the animals display sexual displays but don't watch anybody else's sexual display. You have to have it so that it goes both ways. So you have to inherently want to dance as well as watch other people dance. And so that's what people do. So people are both consumers of sexual displays and they are producers of sexual displays, as well as they are producers of effective action in order to reduce the likelihood of survival problems hurting them. So so leisure activity, what we call fun, you would expect that the nervous system would be constructed in such a way that when the organism was having fun, it would mean that it was increasing its likelihood of gene survival. It wouldn't be having that emotion for a random reason, and it's not. Okay, so any emotion that's in the system is in there for a reason. So any what we call leisure is tickling the neural circuits, indicating that either we are increasing our likelihood of gene survival, or somebody else is, and we are watching them, and we're getting a mirror neuron response. Because after all, we're sitting right there in our Tom Brady jersey, in Boston, watching the Super Bowl, and hell, our our dad named us Brady, for God's sakes.
You have to rub it in, don't you?
So we're having mirror neurons as that goes off, and so people enjoy that process. So that's what leisure activities are. They're not a pleasure trap. They could be. So there are leisure activities like gambling that can be a pleasure trap, and certainly drugs and alcohol are obviously can be pleasure traps. So pleasure trap has to do with supernormal stimuli tilting the scoreboard and messing up the matrix, the motivational matrix, as the organism attempts to orient its behavior optimally. You could see the possibility that theoretically great art, in other words, acting, singing, things like that, could potentially mess with the matrix because it's supernormal. So you could see some guy that doesn't have much of a life, doesn't have a job, has a pension that got left to him by his Uncle Louie, and he's got, kind of health problems, and he's not very good shape, and he's got bad skin, and he doesn't, he's not very socially competent. And the guy just sits, on his couch and watches Seinfeld reruns and eats Cheetos. Okay. So the supernormal aspect of Seinfeld, the fact that it's interesting people saying interesting things and interesting situations come up, and it's creative and interesting and funny. That could actually cheapen his life experience and make it less than if he had to go out there, with a sword and a chisel and actually find his own food and hustle and join a coalition for protection. So it is possible that some of these so-called leisure activities could become pleasure traps in their own way, but usually not. So usually they're just sort of interesting tickling of the circuits that can be very pleasant when they're kept in some kind of reasonable balance.
Well, good, because I enjoy listening to your ideas, Dr. Lau, and I was hoping you wouldn't say that podcasts are pleasure traps. So I'm glad you.
Yeah, this podcast is definitely not a pleasure trap. Not close. Yeah.
Well, so
all right.
Our next. So in terms of people who say get addicted to video games, that is a pleasure trap,
mm-hmm.
because
yeah.
what solving problems in wartime and
right.
battle and such, where that's not really
yeah.
what's happening.
Right. Yeah, that's actually a really interesting. That is a pleasure trap. So these people have gotten ingenious about creating video games and making them interactive to the point where people, it feels inherently very productive, and they're competing for legitimate like status and little group and so forth. So again, that this is essentially out of balance. I think it's probably clear that some people will not will neglect and not take on legitimate challenges that they would that they could potentially improve their legitimate competitive status if they were not sinking enormous amounts of time in those games. However, we cannot be sure that in any individual case that this is actually a mistake. So it depends on how much they enjoy it. Depends on what their competitive prospects would be if they weren't doing it all the time, and what feedback they would get in other domains. So we wouldn't say the same thing probably about somebody that just loved to play volleyball. We'd say, hey, Harry really loves to play volleyball. Down there on the beach all the time. He's in great shape. He's just playing volleyball, volleyball, volleyball. And we'd say, well, that's not unreasonable. Okay. But it's unreasonable that some kid named Joey plays video games all the time. It's like, really? I'm not so sure that it's that different. I think that's how I see it. I see that it's more a matter of, is the person neglecting to actually compete in some ways that would be more fulfilling for them? And are they making a mistake out of, you know, intimidation and fear? That's really what the fundamental issue is.
Fascinating. Yeah, I've often wondered that there's similar addictions out there, but some are more favored than others. Like what you said, volleyball, sports, you know, things like that. Whereas if someone's, say, addicted to video games, we have that stereotype of the, like you said, the Cheetos eating person, and they're, you know, overweight, and they're playing video games, you know, 6 hours a day. Whereas you can have someone playing a sport several hours a day or doing some sort of competitive process, but they're not quite as shamed, I guess, by society.
Right. Yeah, it seems more. It's a more legitimate sexual display, and therefore we sort of see that as more legit. However, notice that the video game person, it isn't really that far. For example, it's extremely similar mental activity to trying to be an effective stock trader. So if that individual was in fact a very effective stock trader, then we would not be, you know, looking cross-eyed at them and what it is that they're doing. So I think in principle, you know, there's certainly dangers that those are pleasure traps and that they can derail a motivational system, but it isn't necessarily the case, and I don't think it's usually particularly dire.
Fascinating. Dr. Lyle, our next question is, can you speak more on faux esteem that you mentioned in previous episodes in relation to social media and cell phones? What is it, and how can we separate ourselves from that facade?
The way to think about esteem, I don't know that I used the term faux esteem. I usually use that in context of status with respect to humor, but it doesn't really matter. I know what they're speaking of. They're speaking of what I call pseudo-esteem. So what we want to do is we want to think about esteem processes really at three levels. So the most fundamental level of esteem that drives motivation and is where the rubber hits the road at evolution is what we're going to call esteem. So that's the decisions that real-life people make when they look at us and they judge us and evaluate us in order to determine whether or not they want to trade with us in some way. There's three primary domains of trade. Those domains would be mating, be friendship, or it would be just trade or exchange processes, market processes, i.e. in these day and age, we would call it employment. A long time ago, we would call it barter. So those are the three main markets that human beings essentially compete in. Those are the markets they compete in. I actually don't know of another market that they compete in. There's a fourth class of relationships that we call family. I put those to the side because they don't inherently need to be competitive. Now, sometimes they are because family relationships are effectively a special kind of friendship, and families are the result of mating relationships. So, or in principle, they would be. So this is families may or may not do very much in the way of trade processes with each other, but they might. So, but what families really are, in a sense, is that they're really friendships that are being driven with what we might call a Hamiltonian kicker. In other words, there's an extra value in being self-sacrificial in family relationships because many of your genes are located inside of other bodies. And therefore, if you give up, it may be more useful for you to give up one unit of food because somebody in your family may benefit 1.5x for that, where you might have only benefited 1.0x. And so therefore, it's valuable for you to give that up. And it's more likely for you to do that with family than it would be with anybody else, because your genes are being aided and abetted, even though they're not located in your own body. So that's just straight selfish gene theory. William Hamilton figured that out, you know, a long time ago in the early 1960s. So this is families, think of families really, even though we put them off to the side, because they don't have to be competitive. What they really are is they fit right under the friendship domain. That's what they are, which is a special case. Now, God knows, where was I, Nate? What's this question about? Pseudo-esteem. The
question was about pseudo-esteem.
Okay, that's right. So so what you're going to have, that's esteem. So esteem is where the rubber hits the road in evolution. People either esteem you or value you sufficiently, and all of the esteem processes are inherently competitive. In other words, if they esteem you more than they esteem the other person, then they choose you for the trade process. That means, you know, Sarah sleeps with Bill, doesn't sleep with Stu. Why? She values Bill more than she values Stu. Plain and simple. Okay. Steve hires, Ken instead of hiring Bill. Why? Because he values Ken more. Plain and simple. Two people are friends and neither one of them likes some third person very much, but they like him so-so. Why? They value each other more. Okay. The reasons for those values are that there are estimating mechanisms in your brain to analyze who and what kinds of situations are better and worse for your gene survival. So, you know, Sarah likes Ken better than Bill. Why? Because Ken looks like a better overall mate prospect. So maybe he's more handsome. Maybe he makes more money. Maybe he's younger. Maybe he's more athletic. Maybe he's more assertive. Maybe he's more pleasant. We don't know all the reasons, but we know as a gestalt, her nervous system runs a CB on, you know, who she thinks is the most valuable, and she feels more attracted to the one that she considers the most valuable. So your feelings are actually derived from these underlying value judgments. So esteem processes are driving the show in motivation. We seek esteem from other people, okay? And other people seek esteem from us. And we are trying to ferret through the marketplace to try to make the very best trades. We want the best mating prospects, the best friendship prospects, and the most advantageous and profitable trade prospects. We are a hell of a lot more interested in being paid $20 an hour than we are being paid $15. If we find out that for similar work we can get $20, then we go to the guy that's $20. So that's esteem. Now, underneath esteem processes are going to be what we call self-esteem processes. So this particular organism has a funny little characteristic, and that is that it's very sensitive to feedback from other people, and it needs to figure out how to do what? Displays. It's trying to figure out how to display to other people in order to win the esteem competitions with its conspecifics. So that means that it actually is going to spend a lot of time rehearsing to try to figure out and plotting to try to figure out how to win. Now, it's going to turn out that it's been blessed by evolution with a technique for improving its rehearsals or improving its displays, which is going to be an internal audience that watches its own actions. So that internal audience, as it watches the person behave and make efforts at trying to be more effective, throw a football better, paint better, you know, have prettier hair, as the organism attempts to do things that will make itself more effective in displays, it's watching its own efforts. And when it gives a very good effort, its internal audience observes this and gives it a nod of approval. If it does a mediocre job, the internal audience basically frowns and is a little disgusted. Those are the internal reactions of pride and self-loathing, okay, and self-disgust. That's a dimension inside the nervous system. And so that doesn't come really from any other action. It comes from the internal audience watching the actions of the individual and judging them really for their moral character. The internal audience is not quite as interested as you might think in what your actual results are. It's most interested in your effort. It's a very interesting mechanism. Now, so that's the self-esteem mechanism. So the vast majority of happiness is controlled through the self-esteem mechanism. In other words, the person's diligence and excellence at efforts and whether or not they judge themselves pleasantly or negatively based on, you know, what's the character of the efforts that they're making. And then the other major part of happiness, which is actually probably the lion's share of it, is the actual esteem feedback that they get in the competitive marketplace. So this is human nature. So human nature is you have an internal audience watching you and judging your efforts. As long as you work hard, work diligently, it'll give you pretty good feedback. Okay. Now, this is very different, incidentally, than self-confidence. So self-confidence is a different concept entirely. So the individual can estimate their likelihood of success based on cues from what it looks like, you know, in previous actions that they've taken. They can sort of estimate their likelihood of success or failure. And they will have motivation to pursue that activity that will, what we would call their confidence, will be a rating or an assessment about their likelihood of whether or not they're likely to be successful. If they don't think that they're very likely to be successful, they feel a lack of confidence, and the lack of confidence is an essential mechanism that discourages the organism from attempting to do things that it's very unlikely to be successful at. People think, oh, it's terrible to have low confidence. No, it's not. It's absolutely essential that you have low confidence. You must have low confidence in order to stop you from wasting your time and energy pursuing things for which you don't have sufficient talent. So, you know, can you imagine some kid that can't pass the ninth grade, that he shouldn't give up his dream of being an anesthesiologist? You've got to be kidding me. Okay. He should not have very much confidence in his ability to pursue higher education, which is good. So now he knows to not waste his time or energy in those pursuits. Can you imagine if a male who is a 3 or 4 or 5 on the attractiveness scale sort of doesn't suffer from an appropriate lack of confidence in hitting on 8s, 9s, and 10s? It's a disaster. Okay, so his nervous system would consistently find himself more attracted to 8s, 9s, and 10s than the 3s, 4s, and 5s. But he would consistently pursue them, and he would be consistently rejected, and he wouldn't have a lack of confidence, and he'd just continue on and totally fail, which means he would spend his life essentially as a total biological failure. And as a result, it wouldn't be very effective for gene survival. So you can see that confidence is a completely different issue than self-esteem, yet they are super easily confused. And in fact, I haven't met a psychologist other than myself and Dr. Rick Seidel that know the difference. Okay, now, yeah. So this is the difference. The difference is that your self-confidence is a result of your assessment of your competitive standing with respect to esteem markets. These are narrowly defined. So you could be extremely confident in a heterosexual mating market and not confident at all in a job market and not confident at all in a friendship market. Okay? You could be extremely confident in a friendship market and a job market and extremely unconfident with respect to a mating prospects. So they are narrowly defined depending upon, in fact, I mean, it gets finer grain than that. You could be very confident hitting on 6s and not confident at all hitting on 8s. Okay, so this gets to be, you know, the confidence mechanism is all about the assessment of perceived probability of success. This is straight Albert Bandura self-efficacy mechanism. That's where this belongs. Now, we're marching finally to pseudo-esteem. So human beings were designed to be seeking esteem. They sought esteem through competitive displays. They attempted to be as sexy as they could be. They attempted to be as loyal-looking and valuable and least costly as they could figure out how to be in order to be friends. And they tried to have skills and produce either events, i.e. singing, dancing, you know, storytelling, fortune-telling, whatever, or they actually produce things, a gourd that you could use to go down by the river and slurp up some water, whatever, okay? Beads to put around your neck, some elephant that carved out of onyx. So in other words, they tried to do things that other people would exchange their time and energy for. That's what they did. Okay. They were also direct return. They also went out there and just tried to get their own food. That we don't actually put that under trade, but we sort of could. But nobody does that today, so it's really no point at even talking about it. Even in the Stone Age, trading was taking place. Males were trading with females in order to – they were displaying to females their ability to hunt, and females were displaying their ability to gather. And the most basic pair bond process was males and females exchanging effort, coming together at the end of the day and trading what it is that they were the kind of specific food that they are – that they were contracted to with each other in order to obtain. So it's the only species in the world that does that. It's the only species that – where the males specialize in one kind of food and the females specialize in another, and then they trade. So in principle, even at the level of hunter-gatherer subsistence, the trade is still going on. So we have these three domains, mating, friendship, and trade. And how good your feedback is in those domains will largely determine the emotional quality of your life. In other words, you feel good when you get good feedback and you feel bad when you get bad feedback. That's how it works. alongside it, you have a self-esteem mechanism that's watching you as a shadow, and it's like a shadowy coach. And it's kicking you in the sternum when you're doing a mediocre job, and it's patting you on the head when you're doing a good job. So that's what the self-esteem mechanism is it's a feedback mechanism for how diligent you are being in the process of working on these competitive processes. Now, that's the heart and soul of human life, and that's how human life is designed. However, 10,000 years ago, human beings began to farm the land for the first time. And when they did, they found that farming was more effective than hunting and gathering. So it was really two ways that it was more effective. In one way, it was actually more efficient. In other words, there's more calories per hour of expenditure would come a result from farming. And it was also more intensive. In other words, you could get many more calories per square foot. So it turns out that a good estimation is that there's about 100 times as many calories per square foot from farming than there would be from hunter-gathering. That would have happened, you know, even in the early days, just without hothouses or anything like that. So as a result of that, what happened is that there would be 100 times more people per square foot. So now you have cities. So what happened was that these early little trading markets where one person would farm one thing and somebody else would farm something else. And you can now imagine what also was happening. Because the farming was more efficient that you could actually get more calories per unit of time, it turns out that not everybody needed to be spending all their time getting food the way they did as a hunter-gatherer. So as a result, there started to be a specialization of labor. And so now suddenly you've got people that can make clothes, and now they don't even farm. They don't even make their own food. Okay, they don't do anything about their food. They just trade for it. They make moccasins, and they trade moccasins for different things that ultimately wind up in them being fed. So you have the rise of markets. Now, what happened was this was very successful, and there started to be not just some little trading area of 30 or 40 people or 50 people. Now it gets to be 1,000 people. So when it gets to be 1,000 people, or you can imagine, let's just make it fun, let's go out to 5,000 people. So when you get to 5,000 people all coming into a town and trading from surrounding farmland that supports those 5,000 people, then it's going to turn out that there's going to be a rise of something that we've never seen before, which is going to be what we call reputations. So in the Stone Age, you could call it a reputation if somebody – you could actually have direct observation of somebody that can actually do something. But in a market, you could hear that somebody could do something and never know that they could ever really do it. You're just taking somebody's word for it. Okay. So now you have this interesting situation where there's a whole different esteem process that has developed. So now there is what I'm going to call pseudo-esteem. So pseudo-esteem is people may believe something is true about you, but they don't even know. They haven't watched it with their own eyes. They just heard about it. And we could actually go almost beyond that. We could actually call it pseudo-pseudo-esteem, that we don't even know why we think they're cool. We just think they're cool because other people think they're cool. All right? So, like, I don't know what Paris Hilton or who's the other one, Kardashian, ever did. You know? So the so this is now pseudo-esteem. So pseudo-esteem is we have an opinion or, a feeling and an orientation towards an individual. We're giving them status, and we don't even know why. It's quite interesting. So you can see that in this situation, what's going to happen is there will literally be a competitive market will arise over pseudo-esteem. Now, in the hunter-gatherer situation, there was competitive markets, but it had to do with esteem. You saw it with your own eyes. You watched people with your own eyes. You had your own memories rating different individuals for their character, their strength, their beauty, their intelligence, their honor, okay? The deeds that they've done, the creative thoughts that they've had. You're esteeming people for your direct assessment of their value to you. In a city, that starts to go by the wayside. Now, most of your life is still being run by esteem processes. Your boss esteems you or doesn't esteem you. Your mate esteems you or he doesn't. Your kids, your friends, etc. Most of what matters to you is still.
Hey, Dr. Lyle. Sorry about that. Looks like we had some technical difficulties and your call got dropped.
Yeah.
So
okay, are you there?
We are back on. Yep, we are back on now. So we'd like you to continue. We were going over the – well – yeah, I kind of dropped off a little earlier than you did. So
yeah, I know what happened. You listened to me talk for long enough, and you said, enough already. Let's give him a cue. All right. Sorry about that. So now, where we're going now is pseudo-esteem. So you can see how seductive pseudo-esteem would be. If you could get a bunch of positive reputation and not earn it, if you could trick people into it, this would be a very, very cool thing to do. It would be very smart. It could be savvy. And you could wind up influencing people's decisions towards you in a way that would be positive if you could do this. Okay? So this is now what the modern world has turned into. This is what, you know, social media has now become. Social media has now become a competitive social it's become a pseudo-esteem marketplace where people are attempting to earn esteem in ways that are effectively not legitimate. They're just finding ways to try to display correlates of cool in order to win esteem. Now, that doesn't mean that, as we can understand, that there isn't some legitimacy under the process. So people can be making legitimate displays. They can be earning legitimate esteem by doing things that are potentially legitimately impressive. But you can also imagine that in pseudo-esteem markets, the data is a lot flakier. And so what this is, this winds up being and can be a little bit like it can be a dominance hierarchy climbing trap, and it can also be a pleasure trap. In other words, you can get an awful lot of excitement over indications that you have won a bunch of pseudo-esteem because somehow you did something that everybody thought was really cool, or they thought you did something that you thought you were cool. So you can imagine, for example, some guy showing pictures of himself on the top of Kilimanjaro, and it was done with, cut and paste, what do you call that thing? Photoshop, okay? So, like, how amazing is that? Or you can have someone looking
Photoshop
to the world like there's – what's that?
Photoshop, yeah.
Yeah, Photoshop. And or you can have someone looking like they're a lot more attractive than they really are. And so they're getting all this woo-wah feedback, but it's not true. And so this, so it can feel good to get pseudo-esteem feedback, but at the same time, the internal audience is watching this process and knows it's bogus. And the self-esteem mechanism is aware, or the esteem mechanism is aware that you don't have any real esteem, that we're bluffing and we're trying to hope to get some real esteem out of it. So the so you can see how this would be a very, very enticing prospect. There would be legitimate reasons to try to go after pseudo-esteem. So if you're Tide, you know, you want everybody to think that you're the best laundry detergent. So you say, I don't know, 4 out of 5 dentists think you ought to be, you know, you ought to be washing your clothes with Tide. In other words, everybody's going to be trying to use pseudo-esteem processes to try to angle for different kinds of decisions. And so, of course, pseudo-esteem, we can't say that it wouldn't be valuable. The,
Dr.
Lyle, a time in a...
I hope you don't brush your teeth with laundry detergent because, yeah.
Maybe I should. It'd be whiter. The so, but the point is that that pseudo-esteem, I think, I can't remember what the original question was, but I think what you want to do is the following, that the pursuit of pseudo-esteem should be integrated with the pursuit of esteem. And the pursuit of esteem should be integrated with the pursuit of self-esteem. So the correct way to, you know, to go about the esteem process of life is to integrate them with the self-esteem mechanism. So that means paying attention to the internal audience as it watches you and judges what it is that you are doing and how it is that you're going about doing it. This is, you know, obviously... there's different names for this across history, including simply conscience. Okay, now, so so that's why there are ways that are more legitimate of pursuing esteem and even pseudo-esteem. So if you earn pseudo-esteem through the legitimate processes of earning esteem, and it so happens that the market finds out about you and a lot of people give you credit because of something that you legitimately did that other legitimate observers observe accurately, and they give you feedback and they value you and they essentially want to tell the marketplace, this individual is an outstanding human. They did fine things. I witnessed it. Okay. Then when people come up to that individual and say, my goodness, I'm just overwhelmed with what it is that I learned about you, Mother Teresa. That is a, you know, what a human. Now, if you're legitimately Mother Teresa and if Mother Teresa was legitimate and her own internal audience observed her do things that it admired, then fine. Whatever pseudo-esteem that you happen to get along the way, you do. Okay. But I think it's a bad idea to pursue it for its own sake. Okay, I think the thing to do is, you know, you may want to win an Oscar if you're an actor, but that's the wrong motivation to go into acting. You go into acting because you have a love for the process and you want to do it as well as you can. And when you do whatever it is that you can do and you do the best you can at being the best that you can be, then your self-esteem mechanism says, you know what? You did it as well as you could do it. Good for you. Now, nobody cares. Your movie's bomb and you never become a star. Oh, well. So you didn't get a lot of steam for it. And it was kind of a little bit bitter in that department and you finally had to go back and be a broker. Fair enough. Okay. But you did it the best that you could do. That's how to do this. In other words, we do things the best that we can do, and we do them in the right way. And when we earn self, we will, by the way, incidentally, earn self-esteem in that process. There's no way for that mechanism to misfire. It's going to work. Okay? Now, we may not earn esteem, but if we fail to earn esteem, then we will get feedback mechanisms about our competitive standing. And the feedback mechanisms will tell us, you know what? You don't have enough talent to compete at that level in this domain. You need to do something else or you need to reset your sights on what you're capable of. That's fine. every eighth grader finds out that they're not going to be Jerry West or Michael Jordan, and they readjust their life path accordingly. It's not a problem, and it's not a crisis. It's not even close. It's a necessary process of life to accept negative feedback in competitive domains and then be able to recalibrate where it is that we're going to put our time and energy. This is essential to the computer program that runs your life. Not a problem. So what we do is that we continue to look inside and earn the self-esteem, and we get sensitive to watching that mechanism and its functions. That's probably the most valuable thing that I'm ever going to tell anybody. Get sensitive to the self-esteem mechanism because it's not super loud. I'll tell you what drowns it out: pseudo-esteem. Pseudo-esteem, completely unnatural to the organism, and a bunch of people cheering you, but you cheated at what it is that you did. You're Lance Armstrong. How about that, dude? You talk about one of the most haywire nervous systems you're ever going to run into, and one of the most haywire, tragic, bizarre lives. Okay? I don't know, you know, what that's like to live inside that nervous system, and I don't want to know. The much better to be somebody that plays right, plays square, does your best, adjust your goals accordingly relative to your talent, and earn the esteem in the right way from the people that matter. That's the right way to do it. And if it turns out that your reputation goes further than that, which it probably will, on many domains to some degree, then you enjoy the process of pseudo-esteem that the market assigns to you because you deserved it, and it will help your competitive process. I just hired an electrician yesterday to do something for my mother. And the reason I hired him is because a guy that I trust that does air conditioning work for me told me, this guy's good. That's it. Pseudo-esteem. Okay? And he came and he did the thing perfectly, and he was really nice to my mom. And my mom just loved the guy. My mom wanted him to move in. Okay. So pseudo-esteem was the reason why I did not open up the phone book and just pick a name and try to deal with it. I found somebody that had some pseudo-esteem, and it worked nicely. So that's the story of esteem, self-esteem, and pseudo-esteem. And in my judgment, the proper way to view those from as an integrated process from the appropriate angle, which is self-esteem first.
It's fascinating because when you first explained pseudo-esteem maybe a year or two ago on the show, mm-hmm. I took it to mean, I'm sure you explained it in more detail, but I took it as simply, you know, the extra likes you get on a Facebook post, on Instagram, and all the social media. But now, you know, I'm starting to understand a little deeper that it's not just that, it's the pursuit of something you didn't necessarily earn.
The market will assign it to you, you know, as a matter of course. But the pursuit of pseudo-esteem in its own right is a little bizarre. The appropriate pursuit in life is self-esteem and esteem. That's what we should be focused on. So the pursuit of pseudo-esteem, we're getting trapped. And as a result, if you are attempting to optimize your pseudo-esteem, you will not be optimizing your self-esteem and your esteem. So it's kind of a pleasure trap. It's like processed food. It's hyper-concentrated and trying to have a big hit on the nervous system, and it can cause you an exhilaration that the system didn't earn, and the legitimate esteem was not earned, and the self-esteem was not earned. But it can be so loud because you can sniff the efficiency about how much esteem that might, you know, that might win you, okay, that it can be a thrill. You can really tell, sorry to interrupt you, Nathan, but you can really tell the difference when you listen to people that are very accomplished and really went through the mill to earn what it is that they, you know, the abilities that they have. They're not that wild about pseudo-esteem. That's not their, and they'll tell you, you know what? I watch some of the great athletes now these days are really getting this straight. They're getting increasingly sophisticated. It takes a lot to be in the white hot glare of the public light the way many of them are. and you'll listen to the way they talk. And I think a lot of them are talking to each other. And the brutal competitive nature, the tension, the tremendous media tension that a lot of these guys get, I think they basically get it. They have to work so hard these days to be successful. Their attitude is, you know, I don't really care that much what you all think. I care about what I think, and I care about what my teammates think. Okay, that's what I care about. And you'll hear that. And what you hear is echoes of John Wooden. And that is that, and you know, it goes right down through the last 50 years. And this is why you'll see it, I think, a lot in athletics. You'll have a guy like Mike Krzyzewski that has really promoted this. This is the notion of, look, you know, you work hard, you do your job, and whatever the result is the result. You can't control that. And that's a, you know, that's the way, not just for outstanding, highly accomplished people to look at things, but they really need it more. They need that compass more than anybody, because the tremendous temptation and the tremendous both criticism and adulation that comes as pseudo-esteem. And what they really need most is the self-esteem that knows that they did their best. And they need esteem from the people that matter, which is their teammates and their family. Okay, did they do things really well? That's what you need. If you did a really good job and you have a few people that really know what you did and how hard you worked and how honorable you were, what the hell else do we care what anybody else thinks? That's the most important thing that matters.
And as these explanations come out more and more, do you think that people will find it less and less fascinating to watch sports as they simply are observing people with just as much hard work as anybody could have, just more genetic talent or just genetic you know, positives that allow them to compete at that level?
Well, I think we're inherently fascinated with outliers. So because we like to see extraordinary ability. That's we like to see it because it's potentially valuable in theory. It's touching some, you know, Stone Age circuits. So we got a bunch of people watching Miss America because these pretty women are in principle valuable because they could produce pretty children. Okay. And so, you know, all the women are staring at that thing, trying to figure out how these women got these competitive advantages. We watch sports because we're watching fitness indicators of extraordinary genetics. But those genetics aren't just weird or bizarre. So this isn't somebody that can do a handstand on his finger. Okay, this is somebody that's doing something that looks like a hunting or warfare proxy, and so we're looking at relative abilities there in order to assess the underlying gene quality, and also in sort of respect for a lot of the effort that it took, the conscientiousness and effort and drive that it took to learn the details, not just the genetic extraordinary gifts. So, you know, I think we're always going to be interested in those things. I think we are both displayers of characteristics, and we are consumers of them. So our life is a yin and a yang between making our own displays and also enjoying other people's displays. So the story of the night, though, is once again my favorite story. It's the center, really, of my career, which is that self-esteem is the only thing that you have control over. But you have absolute control over that sucker. Self-esteem you can earn, and if you do earn it, you will get it. Esteem is out of your control, but you certainly have some indirect influence on it, okay? The harder you work, the more determination that you have, and the better you do things and the more that you learn, the more competitive that you're going to get and the more esteem that you're ultimately going to earn. Some people will be more talented than you, and they're just going to get more esteem. The handsome guy or pretty girl just walks in the room, and they get all kinds of esteem. That's just how it is, okay? The great athlete gets a bunch of esteem. The people of great ability get a lot of esteem. That's just how it is, okay? But so we can't guarantee that. But we can guarantee that you are very likely over the long haul, you will get enough esteem in order to satisfy your life, because you are constructed, your nervous system is constructed that way. You will do well. If you do the work, you'll do well. We can't tell how well you'll do, but as we, you know, this is the John Wooden notion, we'll be satisfied with the result. Peace of mind comes from knowing that you didn't leave a lot of potential on the table. Okay, that's where the peace of mind comes from. Did I do a good job at actualizing my potential? If you did, you made a lot of good moves, you didn't skip steps, you worked hard and diligently, the game may not have ultimately come out as well as you would have thought, but that's fine. You can live with that. What you won't live with well is the idea that you did a mediocre job, that you took shortcuts, were lazy, and didn't face the hard work that was necessary to compete effectively in the domains that you needed to. Now, you won't have peace of mind when you do that. You'll have relative degrees of unease and self-disgust, okay? And those feelings are there as a guidance system to tell you that you are letting your competitive potential go down the drain behind either an ego trap or just fundamental distraction and laziness. That's the way it is. Okay, so what we don't want to do is get trapped by the multiplicative elixir of pseudo-esteem. Okay, that's Facebook is potentially, and things like this are potentially a fiasco. And so I read recently, I guess couples fight once a week over Facebook. What the hell is that? That's a very strange, very strange thing. I have people, family members fighting with each other. You know, I have people fighting with best, you know, good friends, all kinds of, you know, rips in social fabric behind frickin' Facebook. Okay. And what is that about? That's about people trying to, you know, finagle pseudo esteem. That's what it is, mostly. Not entirely, but that is certainly a large part of the appeal there. And if it's causing you more angst than it's benefiting your life, get off of it. That's one of the better ideas that a lot of people could adopt. All right. I vented my
words
spleen.
Of Jim Jeffries. What was that?
I vented my spleen.
Well, it's a good preview for your upcoming book, speaking of pseudo-esteem, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
yes.
This is,
yeah, that'll be a major, major component. Yeah.
It was fascinating to hear you lay out this logic of it. And so this upcoming Ego Trap episode, we're looking forward to hearing this mind map of where this is coming from. But in the words of Jim Jeffries, the secret to happiness is to be good looking, it looks like. And in the words of Dr. Lyle, the next best secret to happiness is to do some hard work and something you enjoy, and don't let the pseudo process, esteem processes, get the better of you.
Yes, very good.
All right, Dr. Lyle, as always, appreciate you staying on throughout the tough technical difficulties, but we'll look forward to speaking with you next week.
Very good. Terrific, Nate. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G. and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.
Skydiving. This is amazing.
Yeah, but you know what else is amazing? An iPhone 6S for just $49 at Metro.
Really?
Imagine streaming all the way down with that amazing camera.
I'm switching.
That's smart. You know what else is smart? Parachutes.
Switch to Metro and get an amazing iPhone 6S for only $49. Metro by T-Mobile. Phone offer requires port-in of number not currently active on T-Mobile network or active on Metro in past 90 days. See store for details and terms and conditions.
So you're ready to ask the biggest question of your life, the only question before that question. How do you find the perfect ring to ask it with? With the incredible selection of diamonds at Jared and our price match guarantee, you can dare to stop searching and find the perfect diamond at a price you'll love. Visit your local Jared store today and dare to be devoted.
We promise to match any price on a like loose certified diamond of the same quality from any other jewelry retailer. See Jared.com/pricematch for details.